This is Jeff Blankford. Well, my guest today, Bill Hartung, is director of the Armed Security Project for the Center on International Policy, having previously served at a similar post at the New America Foundation. He's the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and co-edited with Miriam Pemberton, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War. His previous books include And Weapons for All, a critique of U.S. arms sales policies from Nixon to Clinton administrations. His articles on security issues have appeared in most of the country's leading publications and has been a featured expert on national security issues on CBS's 60 Minutes, NBC Nightly News, the Lehrer News Hour, CNN, even Fox News, and scores of local, regional, international radio outlets such as this one. Welcome once again, Bill Hartung, to Takes on the World.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you back. Well, last year you wrote an article that's still very current, the Obama Arms Bazaar Record Sales Troubling Results, that depicted our Nobel Peace Prize winning president as having approved the greatest amount of arms sales to foreign countries of any president in our history, and what effect those arms sales have had in terms of the ongoing wars in the Middle East and the cost in human lives. You also pointed out how little attention this had received from the media or the public, which is why I wanted to revisit the subject today. How bad has it been?
Well, since President Obama came into office, he has approved $195 billion worth of new major arms sales, which outstrips every president since World War II by a long shot, other than maybe Richard Nixon, who also was a big arms exporting president. And as you mentioned, these have real impacts. It's not just money changing hands. It's not just planes sitting on the runway. But, for example, in Yemen, thousands of people have been killed with U.S.-supplied aircraft, U.S.-supplied cluster bombs. Our government has been helping to pick targets and refuel the planes. So we're right in the middle of this thing, which many human rights groups say has been a series of war crimes that have been committed in that conflict. In places like Bahrain, when the democracy movement was put down, Saudi Arabia went into the country using U.S. vehicles to help put down democracy. And then there's been sort of this boomerang effect where a lot of our weapons have ended up in the hands of groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So all in all, you know, not just a big business, but I think terrible security consequences.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, in the old days, it seemed like the Saudis would buy these weapons in order to kind of keep the U.S. arms industry afloat, but not use them. And I remember during the first Bush administration, after the Saudis had largely paid for the first Iraq war, the Saudis announced they didn't have the money to buy a shipment of planes from McDonnell Douglas, and that was going to force the plant to close. And there was a small item in the paper that I saw that Bush had convinced the Saudis that they could do it on a payment plan. And when the deal was announced, they partied all night in St. Louis in the McDonnell Douglas plant, which was almost like a rebate or protection money for the U.S. protecting Saudi's interest in the Middle East. But with the Obama administration, beginning with Bush, the Saudis have been really an aggressive force, and the war on Yemen, which most Americans pay no attention to, has been a major disaster, human rights disaster.
That's right. There were, for a long time, there was this kind of tacit understanding. The Saudis, you know, we'll buy your weapons and you protect us in a pinch. And it wasn't just to protect them from other countries that might intervene, but also helping them keep their own population under control. The U.S. government and U.S. companies have helped equip and train the Saudi National Guard, which is the primary internal security force in the country. And then in Yemen, I mean, there's been bombings of marketplaces, of hospitals, of civilian neighborhoods. And it's pretty clear the Saudis are not trying to avoid civilian casualties. If anything, they're thinking that inflicting them will somehow get the other side to pull back, which has not been the case. So, I think it came from a situation where it was sort of like almost in lieu of an alliance, sort of the arms sales for the bridge for the relationship, to where the Saudis have really, they're almost like the tail that's wagging the dog now. I mean, the Obama administration probably would not have wanted to see a war in Yemen, but they're too tied to the Saudi regime to stand back, and they're actually, as I said, facilitating the war.
Well, that brings up the question of Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation's tie to the Saudis. That the Saudis have contributed over $12 million to the Clinton Foundation. And when Hillary was the Secretary of State under Obama, she oversaw these arms deals, not just to the Saudis, but to other donors to the foundation. How much is there a sharing of responsibilities? I mean, Obama obviously has to give the final approval to this, but Secretary of State Clinton, I remember even seeing an article at some point where she really bragged about having that deal go through with the Saudis.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of forces in play pushing forward a deal like that. Certainly the president is involved. In some cases, the Pentagon has even a greater role than the State Department because they make the initial contacts. They often negotiate the terms of the deal. They collect the money and recycle it to the contractors. So I don't know if the relationship with the foundation was a major factor in deciding these sales, but certainly Secretary Clinton presided over them, and as Secretary of State, her department had to do a sign-off, and I think she was certainly in line with the other members of the administration in supporting these deals.
Well, we certainly wouldn't expect to see any downturn in arms sales if she gets to the White House, which is likely.
I wouldn't think so. The only thing that might result in a downturn is so much has been sold in recent years that some of the countries may need time to absorb what they've already purchased. But certainly I think the use of arms sales, not just to help U.S. companies, but also as kind of a strategy of if you're not going to send hundreds of thousands of troops like the Bush administration did into a region, you'll have a combination of some troops, some special forces, use of drones, and sales to allies to fight some of those fights. So arms sales, I think, have become part of the Obama strategy of what they think is a more politically sustainable way to fight wars with fewer troops directly involved.
Well, it certainly doesn't get the American public concerned at all, and there's nothing that could even be possibly given the name of an anti-war movement or arms sales movement during the Obama administration. And one of the things, of course, we've seen in Yemen is the use of U.S. manufactured cluster bombs, which are designed against anti-personnel weapon, which had been used largely against civilian populations wherever they've been used, whether it was Vietnam or by Israel and Lebanon. And this still hasn't created any kind of uproar among so-called progressives in Congress or among the American people.
Yeah. Well, on the anti-war movement, I mean, there are groups like Win Without War and Peace Action and the Friends Committee on National Legislation trying to fight the good fight. But what has happened is they haven't been joined in the fight by larger mainstream organizations, nor has there been much criticism in the press. So they're fighting an uphill battle. They win some victories now and again, but I think they need a lot more support to really make the kind of difference that we would like to see. And cluster bombs, there's been a couple members of Congress who've now been trying to raise the issue. Representative Conyers of Michigan had an amendment to block any future U.S. sales of cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia, and he came within four votes of winning, which in the Republican House is, somewhat of an accomplishment. Members like Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, combined with Rand Paul of Kentucky, have a bill that would block any new sales of bombs and missiles to the Saudis to try to slow down their war activities. But these have been kind of, I'd say, courageous leaders who are raising this issue when others haven't. And I think they're just getting started on getting some traction of, enough of a level of support in the Congress to really try to stop some of these things.
Even the justification for manufacturing cluster bombs in the first place is open to question. I mean, even President Ronald Reagan stopped the shipment of cluster bombs to Israel during the war in Lebanon in 1982 because of the devastation they were causing to among Palestinian civilians. And then it was resumed later on. But this is a weapon that has no justification, military justification. And yet they continue to be produced here for and keep, I guess it's jobs. You know, it's interesting. Earlier I talked about Raytheon's contract to build the American version of the Iron Dome called Sky Hunter, and realized that there are 43 Raytheon factories in the United States, and that these arms manufacturers, one of the ways they make sure that there won't be congressional objections to what they're doing is by putting factories all over the country. And so members of Congress who try to close these factories or speak against arms control are then going to be called, be criticized for jeopardizing good-paying jobs in their communities. Is this just an accident, or is this smart thinking on the hands of the weapon and the part of the weapons manufacturers?
Well, I think of it as jobs blackmail. You know, basically, unless you support us on these policies, which a lot of people, of course, don't support, you're gonna lose jobs in your district. And you know, sometimes they exaggerate their reach. Lockheed Martin did a sort of interactive map to show how important the F-35 fighter plane was to the economy. And in a lot of cases, they were claiming jobs that didn't exist, and they claimed about twice as many jobs as actually were created, and that many states had only marginal involvement. So sometimes they puff it up, and they sort of scare some members, even when they might not have a lot of a presence in their district. But bottom line is, you know, there are a lot of plants. They use subcontractors strategically. Sometimes they'll actually move a factory into the district of an important member to sort of keep them on board. So it's kind of the argument and lobbying tool of last resort, I would say. You know, there's campaign contributions, there's hiring former government officials, there's funding think tanks that sort of promote, you know, aggressive policies that benefit the contractors. But I think when push comes to shove and none of those arguments are working, they fall back on the jobs issue.
I noticed the New York Times actually had an article about how leading think tanks are being used by corporations in order to get legitimacy to their projects. And everywhere you look in the United States, you see just manifest corruption, I guess, on a higher level than most countries. But as long as most of the people appear to be reasonably satisfied, well, maybe not now at the moment, but they get away with it. There's no... The government seems to be, someone has joked, a government of corporations, by corporations, for corporations, and an argument could be made that that's the case. That F-35 is an example. You brought it up. This is some people call it a boondoggle. Billions of dollars have been spent on a plane that may or may not actually be the fighter plane of the future for the wars of the future, but we've roped in at least a dozen countries, have spent billions of dollars, including Norway, Australia. This is to fight a world war or another war off in the future. It's a very depressing scenario. Why are these countries doing this? Are they getting kickbacks? Is this some kind of game that they're playing on their respective publics?
Well, I think a lot of them have similar ideologies in their defense establishments where there's sort of threat inflation and they sort of run on fear to justify some of these systems. There are a lot of foreign companies who have a piece of the F-35. In fact, when we did our report on it, we found as many foreign companies as U.S. companies in on the deal. And they're competing for some of the bigger pieces of it. There's going to be a final assembly plant in Italy. Now they're talking about putting one in Japan. So they're spreading the jobs around the world, and that's one of the reasons their claims about jobs here ring a little bit hollow, because they're giving a lot of those jobs away. You know, that they're exporting them as part of the deal to sell these planes. But there are opposition groups. I mean, there's opposition in the UK and Norway and Italy to buying these things. but they haven't been able to turn the tide as yet. There is the new government in Canada is reconsidering whether to buy the F-35, and that comes off a long push from non-governmental organizations to question that deal, which was apparently arrived at through corrupt means. They didn't follow the procurement practices that are normally followed in a Canadian purchase of a weapon system. So, there's some grumbling, but so far they've been able to keep it more or less on track. There's been some slowdowns in the U.S. because of performance problems, but now they're saying, oh, it's ready to roll, and they're declaring some of them operational. And there was this piece about how it's, the greatest plane ever by a guy named Lauren Thompson, of course, whose think tank is funded by Lockheed Martin, which makes the F-35. So my guess is they're not going to be able to build it in the huge numbers they hope to just because it's going to cost too much and it's not going to perform the way they want. And, of course, I would prefer that these things not be used because, a fighter plane in these day and age, what is it for? I mean, are they going to have dogfights with China? Are they going to bomb countries that don't have any aircraft systems? And there's just no rationale for building this numbers of fighter planes off into the future decades as is currently planned.
Yeah, in 1964, Stanley Kubrick made his classic comedy, black comedy, Dr. Strangelove. But more and more we see representatives of the military establishment, like retired General John Allen, at the Democratic Convention, and then I've heard and seen spokesperson for NATO countries, and they seem to be insane. They seem to be living in a totally another world, and it's like Alice in Wonderland. You need a writer like Jonathan Swift or Lewis Carroll to put all this down because it isn't believable. I mean, the F-35 fighter, what do they cost at the moment? $100 million apiece? More?
More, yes. They play with the numbers, but it's certainly well above $100 million.
And how much has the United States spent on this so far, even given the fact that other countries are also wasting their taxpayers' monies on it?
Well, if they built everything they wanted, over the next 30, 40 years and to maintain them and so forth would be $1.4 trillion, which make it the most expensive weapon system the Pentagon has ever undertaken. A lot of that's yet to be spent, but they've been spending at a clip of about $10 to $12 billion a year, and of course they spent other billions and billions on the development of the plane. So it's among the most expensive things in the Pentagon budget, along with things like aircraft carriers or the various missile defense programs that they're funding.
Now you mentioned that under President Obama, deals been made with India to provide them in the beginning with military transport planes, but torpedoes, anti-ship missiles, and howitzers, and you say they're now going to help India develop aircraft carriers and a new generation of jet engines. This is kind of mind-boggling. I know one interesting thing is the United States is in negotiations with Israel about a $45 billion 10-year military aid package. What would be different about this kind of aid package, usually Israel is allowed to spend 25% of the money on its own weapons industry or whatever, however it wants to spend it. But given that Israel is now a competitor, even with India, a competitor with the United States arms industry, Obama administration wants Israel to spend all the money in the United States, and Israel, Netanyahu, and his defense minister, Lieberman, are balking at that. Maybe we comment on that deal.
Yes. Over the years, U.S. aid has helped plant the seeds of the Israeli arms industry. They may have gotten there eventually anyway, but it accelerated the process. And now technology like drones, for example, they have top-of-the-line technology, and they're exporting it all over the world. So I think part of it is the Obama administration stepping back and saying, do we want to be strengthening an economic competitor although they're a political ally? And I think the industry has grumbled about this arrangement for years, because they, of course, want all of that money. And when you talk about military aid, it doesn't really help the recipient country economically, because the money just goes right back into the coffers of Lockheed Martin or Boeing or Raytheon, whichever company's weapon system is being purchased with that aid. And some countries are, the citizenry is sort of onto this. And, you know, there's been a lot of protests in Egypt about, you know, why are you calling this aid when basically it's subsidies for U.S. Companies.
Well, that's an interesting point, which is rarely brought up in discussions about U.S. arms. And in fact, it's another way of U.S. taxpayers subsidizing American corporations, irrespective of the product that is being produced. It just doesn't seem to come up. But it is interesting in terms of this international arms market that countries seem to feel they need to have an air force, even though they don't have any immediate neighbors or any use for them. There seems to be probably kickbacks, as we hear, to those people who are negotiating, kickbacks all around. And when the publics of these countries don't know anything about it, there are very few investigations. I mean, it very rarely gets out. Now, you've been pointing out, you've been writing about and watching this for years. Do you see any real resistance on the part of the public or in Congress at any point to stop this, to turn it around? There doesn't seem to be any debate, even in the Democratic debates. The military-industrial complex was not mentioned once by either Secretary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. It was off the table, and I don't think that was an accident.
Yeah, I think there have been members who've stood up. Barney Frank, unfortunately now has retired, made some important initiatives talking about how you could cut $1 trillion over the Pentagon's 10-year plan. Members will speak out on specific issues, like Rep. Conyers on the cluster bomb issue. But there hasn't been a caucus in Congress trying to keep the Pentagon under control, whereas there is, for example, a caucus to promote the F-35. So there's a long way to go, I think, to get a movement in Congress to really try to rein in this stuff. And I think in terms of the public, you know, the Chicago Council on Foreign Affairs does these periodic polls of American views on foreign policy. And inevitably, people are opposed to the idea of the U.S. government being a major arms exporter, but it's not a salient issue. They're not voting on it. They're not hearing about it. Most people would be surprised to know that the United States is far and away the biggest arms exporting country in the world. So I think part of it is education. Part of it is then the pressure that education might generate. But, you know, it's all up against powerful forces, which, you know, as you've suggested.
You said there's an F-35 caucus in Congress. These are members of Congress who are supporting and making sure the F-35 stays on track. Obviously, they have probably received more than chub change from Lockheed Martin.
Well, yeah, it's twofold. They'll get significant contributions from Lockheed Martin and the other contractors involved in building the plane. Also, many of them have some sort of subcontract in their district to build part of the plane. And sometimes when a member joins the caucus, they'll sort of, you know, mention that it's partly because they have a company in their district that is involved in the project. So they view it as a form of constituent service.
In your article that the Obama arms czar, you did mention at least something slightly positive. The Obama administration had support for a global arms trade treaty, ATT, which Bush had opposed, but Obama, you say, supports the treaty, but is anything happening on that is really controlling the arms trade at all, or is this just something on paper?
Well, on the United States front, the administration hasn't put it forward to be ratified by the Senate because there's been a letter by 50-some members promoted by the NRA saying they would never ratify such a treaty. And the NRA has decided to sort of be a global player on this, and their propaganda is that if you start controlling guns and weapons globally, the next thing you know, the UN's going to take your guns away in the U.S., which is absurd, of course, and it's probably mostly a fundraising pitch for them. But nonetheless, they've become an impediment to promoting things like the Arms Trade Treaty. In terms of countries that have ratified, it's become an issue of strong debate, but the places that are most important, like Russian Iranian arms to Syria, they're not signed on to the treaty. The UK, which has signed on, is being sued by some civilian groups because they argue that it sells to Saudi Arabia, are violating both the Arms Trade Treaty and British policy. So I think the problem with the treaty is that I think it sets good standards, but it sort of leaves it up to each country to live up to those standards. So it basically throws it right back into the political process. I think it was important that it's been created, but for it to have teeth really depends on the kind of battles politically that happen in each of the major supplying countries.
My guest is Bill Hartung, arms control expert. He's been doing this for a long time and monitoring this. One of the more troubling aspects of your article, which I had not seen elsewhere, was how the Obama administration removed thousands of items from the State Department's monitored U.S. munitions list and transferred them to the Commerce Department. And so instead of being administered and supervised and watched over by human rights groups, these weapons, not the most sophisticated, but the other kinds that kill, are just being seen as other business items, commercial items, overseen by the Commerce Department. Perhaps you comment on that.
Yes. This is an initiative that the arms industry pushed for a couple decades, and finally they got a good amount of what they wanted. The administration will argue, we're still going to keep an eye on these things, even though the Commerce Department is now in charge of giving out the licenses for many of them. But commerce is involved. Their job is to generate business. And so if they're the lead agency, they're likely to be, more generous, provide less scrutiny over sales to countries that might use these things in the midst of conflicts or for human rights abuses and so forth. So I think it's a step backward, and it didn't get a huge amount of attention as you indicated. But I think there's still I think some of these things need to be rolled back, especially some of the things related to small arms, which I do a lot of the killing and the kinds of conflicts that we see now in the world. And it's also, some of these things can now go without a license to U.S. allies, everybody from Argentina to Bulgaria to the U.K. And in some of these countries, there's front companies that will get a hold of these U.S. Weapons components, which now can get into those countries license-free. And they'll buy them, and then they'll transfer them to groups in Iran or China or other places that would otherwise be prohibited from getting these weapons components. So I think it's also enabling and will enable more illicit arms trading.
And, of course, as you point out, many American weapons that have been gone to so-called allies have ended up in the hands of ISIS, Al-Qaeda.
Yes, through one channel or another. There's a group called Conflict Armaments Research, funded by the European Union, which went into Iraq and surveyed some of the battlefields protected by some of the Kurdish militias. And of the things that they found, mostly ammunition, about a quarter of it seemed to be of U.S. origin, which means it was probably captured either from the Iraqi military, which abandoned a lot of their equipment in their first interactions with ISIS when that war started, or some of the groups the U.S. has been arming in Syria, some of which sold the weapons off, or ended up joining ISIS because ISIS seemed to be, the most powerful group in the midst of that war. So one way or another, you'll see these weapons ending up in the wrong hands. In Yemen, about $500 million worth of U.S. Military equipment disappeared from a base there, and it's thought to either be with the Houthi rebels who are fighting the Saudis, or possibly even with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So, that's the other element of this, is that even kind of the most hawkish of hawks has got to be somewhat concerned about the fact that these things are just, going right out the door to U.S. adversaries.
Well, and one thing you bring up in the article, which is really troubling, is the export of armed drones, or drones capable of carrying arms and bombs, to questionable U.S. allies. And this proliferation of drones seems to be the coming thing, and it makes it a lot easier for countries, certainly the United States, to attack other countries without putting boots on the ground or worrying about the citizenry being upset about taking casualties. Perhaps you comment on this expansion of the drones in the military, use of the military.
Yes, there was a kind of a policy discussion within the administration about how to handle this. And they've decided to make, under certain criteria, allow for exports of armed drones, which were not allowed before. So far, the deals that have been talked about are with European allies, but if the process is allowed to continue, I could imagine them ending up with Gulf countries or in other places where they're more likely to be put to immediate use against the local population. And of course, for their use by the United States has its own serious problems. I mean, there's questions of the legality of it, given that there's not really an authorization, even in our own Congress, for the kind of broad global war that's been fought by the Bush and Obama administrations. So when they're using drones in Yemen and Pakistan and Somalia and other places, there's no explicit authorization from the Congress to be doing that. There's also questions under international law of whether you can be targeting people for assassination. There's questions about who are they targeting. Do they know who they're targeting in some cases? And, of course, you've got civilian casualties, which create a backlash. And so there's a lot of hatred from the United States in some of the areas that have been targeted for these strikes, not by Al-Qaeda or ISIS, but by local population who are frightened by these things. Sometimes they're sort of hovering there. You can even sort of hear them lurking. And so it creates a great deal of fear among locals and a resentment of the United States, which is hard to reverse.
Well, apparently very few of these drones attack military targets. They're usually like people in meeting in private homes. It's like a kind of terror from the air, which obviously will turn people who might have otherwise been supportive of U.S. policy or against U.S. enemies, it would, turn them against the United States and create recruits for ISIS.
Yeah. I think there are, the way I see it is, it's a case of negligence in many cases. They're not taking care to figure out, are they legitimate military targets? They're not taking care to figure out, are there civilians in the area who would also be killed or wounded in going after an Al-Qaeda operative? So the net result is you get significant civilian casualties. The administration has put out some numbers of what they think civilian casualties have been or what they're willing to admit. But independent groups have said that the figures the administration has put out are far too low. I think it's going to be an ongoing debate. It's been a little less salient recently because the numbers of strikes have somewhat diminished from the early Obama years when they were going at a much more rapid clip than, for example, the Bush administration had been. But I think it's an issue that has to be stayed after because it's sort of this seductive notion that somehow you can he can wage war without consequences, and there are all kinds of consequences for not only the victims of these strikes, but for the future of United States image in the world.
Well, on that note, we've come to the end of the hour. How do people get a hold of your writings? What's the best way?
Well, if they go and Google either me, William Hartung, or my organization, the Center for International Policy, my page will pop up, and it's got all of my reports and articles listed there. So that's the easiest way, I would say.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World. Another depressing hour, but unfortunately we live in depressing times, and maybe the only way to go is up from here. So anyway, thanks so much for the work you're doing and for keeping people abreast of this ongoing problem.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.